session number 11718, reel 4.
Mr. Klaus Hofer, reel 4.
Yes, with a covering letter to the paper, and I even had postage stamps, and my idea was to go somewhere and find a mailbox and send those letters off. And I had to get out of the camp for that. So what I did was I managed to procure an unmarked American uniform, just a plain gabardine shirt, trousers, and a hat. And the idea was for me to go out of the camp because I was able to go through the fence in connection with my work. And so one day I took my prisoner's uniform off, sprinkled it with pepper. The idea was to throw the bloodhounds off the scent. when young, foolish ideas. And I stowed it away in a boiler house and put on the American uniform and just walked out of the camp with those letters in my pocket. And unfortunately, I was just passing around a pile of wood when I heard behind me, "Halt!" And I turned around and there was a mounted military policeman. So I tried to bluff it out, you know, but of course my English wasn't good enough. And he realized there was a escaping prisoner. So at gunpoint, I was marched back to the camp. And before I had a chance to get rid of these letters, they found them on me. And of course, the colonel was informed, and he was very upset. He was very angry. So it was 14 days bread and water in the stockade. Actually, some of the guards were very nice. They realized the whole story, and they brought me candy and things, which I tied to pieces of string and hung out the window on the offside of the barracks where the cell was. Of course, they were also found and confiscated. And I think I was released a week earlier. I think I only spent about a week in the thing. And then they decided I was too much of a troublemaker and I had to be transferred. So they gave me two guards with rifles, and I was put on a train, and we traveled amongst civilians and army and armed forces personnel, halfway across the country from Colorado to Kentucky. And in Kentucky, they had a special camp. It was called a protection camp. And they had everything there. They had communists, homosexuals, and people who got into trouble with the Nazis. So I spent most of that was after 6 months in that first camp. I spent the rest of my time as a prisoner of war, a year and a half in the protection camp, and it was pretty much the same. It was a big armored camp, and we worked mostly around the camp, but also on farms.
So the protection referred to the need for protection from the National Socialists?
Yes, from the fanatics, yes.
Yeah. Were there many in this protection camp?
Yes, there was, in fact, in Camp Campbell, which it was then called. Now it's called Fort Campbell, rather big army camp, armored thing was then. There were three compounds of 1,000 prisoners each. Now one compound, 1,000, was an ordinary, which we always refer to as the Nazi camp, completely separated. And two of the others were protection camps. But I think they were probably the only ones in the States. I couldn't say. There were a lot of prison camps all over the States because, as I say, they held, you know, hundreds of thousands of prisoners.
And did you speak to many of the other people in the protection camp about
yes.
what they'd experienced in their clashes with
yes.
the National Socialists?
Well, no, not about, well, not much. I mean, we knew what was happening. I mean, we... It was a very mixed bunch anyway. I mean, you had certain friends and others you hardly knew. I mean, it wasn't like that. I mean, because my best friends were a couple of other Austrians, and you sort of tend to hang around with your buddies and hardly ever know anybody else. There was the only thing, and I'm not sure about now, is there was one fellow who was rather pale and chap, and he said, and you know, we got to talking, and asked him what he did in civilian life at home, and he said he was an opera singer, and so it sort of stuck in my mind, and later on, I heard that Dieter Fisch Disco, Fischer Disco, had been an American prison camp. My only doubt is that. Because I think Fischer Disco is a rather tall fella. And I remember him as rather short, but then either he could have grown, because we were only about 20 then. Either he was sitting down when I talked to him and I didn't realize that he was tall, or he had grown later, but it could very well be that it was Fischer Disco.
Coming back to the camp in Colorado, first of all, what was its name?
It was called Camp Greeley. Like, you know, go west, young man. Horace Greeley.
G-R-E-E-L-Y.
L-E-Y.
L-E-Y.
I think it's L-E-Y. Yeah. And that was a prison camp, pure and simple. There was no army camp attached. It was brand new, just built as a prison camp, out in the middle of nowhere. And I think it had three compounds of 1,000. They were standard, 1,000 prisoners to a compound.
And just to recapitulate what you said, I understood you to have said that on Hitler's birthday, April 1944...
April 20th.
April the 20th, 1944... Yeah. The camp authorities there allowed the National Socialist
Prisoners... Yes, well, not only that, but I mean, they sort of seemed to actively encourage it. I mean, he was very proud. He was standing, I can see him still standing there in his jeep, you know, and grinning and saluting and all that.
What were they carrying in the parade?
Well, they were just having a march past, you know, with probably singing and as right and so on and all that stuff.
But do you think that the camp commandant understood the significance of it?
That I don't know. But I think he was very pleased about the military precision and all that. You know, he liked this, the military thing, you know. And of course, we, who had opted out of all this, you know, were rather a disorderly, motley group, and he didn't much appreciate that. He rather preferred the nice, disciplined... marching and drilling of the Germans, you see. I don't think it was a political thing with him, but it was. But he certainly didn't do anything to protect us.
So it was a matter of order, as far as he was
concerned. Yes, I think so. I think it was a matter of. I mean, we were regarded as troublemakers, and what he wanted was order.
But after this, you said the attack started?
Well, yes, there was, you know, was trouble threats mainly in my case. I wasn't actually ever roughed up or anything, but it was threatening. And I was afraid that it might, you know, it was getting worse, you see. And I thought I better do something, you know, because it was getting a bit hairy. Because we had heard from rumors, you know, from other sources, that in other camps there had been killings.
What kind of threats were made against you?
Well, verbal threats, you see, mainly.
But what kind of things were said?
Well, I don't know, traitor and all this sort of thing, you know, and you know, the sort of politically
But why should you have been a traitor?
Because I wasn't supporting the German war effort. We were going around telling them, here, stop this, all this nonsense. The war is over. The war is lost. Now, if you told a fanatical German that the war was lost, you were a traitor. And they wouldn't have shrunk from doing violence to you, beating you up at the best.
Do you remember the individuals who took the leading part in the threats?
No, there was one that I remember, but only because he was a fellow Austrian of whom I expected better, and he was always boasting about his exploits in the war. You know, he was also captured in Cassino, and he used to say, you know, how he was shooting his machine gun until the barrel got red hot, you know, and all that sort of thing. And you know, and, he was rather a fanatic. But I mean, you stayed away from these people as much as you could. But you know, if I had to do it again, I probably would be more careful nowadays. But in those days, you know, you were a bit euphoric. We thought, oh my goodness, it's all over, you know. They can't do anything to you anymore. And I really didn't expect them to because they were well off in those camps. They had marvelous food and all sorts of good treatment. I should have thought, you know, they would be grateful for that. But no, some of them still kept to the ideology. And in fact, this friend of mine who visited me recently, the one who had been imprisoned, he told me about some former colleagues of mine, two of them, and he says they still, even after all these years, are in favor of the Nazi movement. I suppose it's characteristic of some people to be like that. Well, you got new Nazis almost everywhere in Germany, Austria, even in this country, you got some fascist elements, haven't you?
Yes. Did the American authorities in the camps try to conduct any propaganda against National Socialism?
Well, yes. I mean, not at first, because it wasn't necessary. We had no German papers or anything like that. All we had was the American radio, and we had lots of radio, and German and American magazines and papers we had. And that, of course, was all war propaganda then anyway. And unless, if you didn't listen to the radio or read anything, then of course you didn't hear anything. It was only later, and that was after the war, because we weren't immediately repatriated after the war. We were in prison camp until March 46 in America. Was it March 46? I think it was March 46. Yes. And after the war, then we were taken to a cinema, because we were taken to the cinema every week and saw these ordinary American films, you know, that were, you know, Rita Hayworth and all that. But after the war, they took us one time to the cinema and showed us the concentration camp films in order to show us what had happened, you see. A lot of people didn't believe it, but I think probably most of them did.
What was your reaction to them?
Well, I believed it. I knew what they were capable of, because not to that extent, perhaps. But it wasn't. I mean, it didn't have all these statistics. And I must say, although I believe most of it, I think a lot of it has been vastly exaggerated. And I don't think there's anything like 6 million or anything like that. But perhaps, I don't know about numbers, But there are terrible things that have happened. And not only better Germans, but after the war, even after the war, by the Poles and Czechs and so on, there was mass killings. And that was after the war, not during the war. So I don't think we'll ever know the truth or the extent of it. But I watched this film, The Holocaust, and I thought it was pure propaganda. I mean, it wasn't even credible, because there was simply no. There was no reason for it. I mean, it was exaggerated and colored, and you don't need to color that. I mean, it's bad enough as it is, perhaps more horrible, but I don't think this is completely free of propaganda.
So the Nazis just said it was American propaganda when they saw this type of thing.
Do you mean the prisoners?
Yes, the Nazi POWs.
Yes, but they said they didn't believe that. No, in fact, they made jokes about it, which I thought was rather in bad taste. There was a news program, cinema news in Germany during the war, which was called Die Tönende Wochenschau, which means the Sound Week Review. And they made a joke out of it, of this concentration camp film, by calling it Die Höhnende Knochenschau, which means the ridiculous bone show, you see.
Did you ever have any Jews who were in charge of you in America?
No. Well, there could have been, but I can't recall any. I can't really.
What about the work that you were required to do on the farms? Did you do that farm work yourself?
Well, me personally, I was usually sent along as interpreter. But the chaps who did it, yes, we did all sorts of farm work. Sugar beets in Colorado and tobacco in Kentucky, and various farm jobs. The thing was, there were details sent out depending on the farmers. See, the farmers requested a certain number of people, and a detail was made up, say, 6 people, 10 people, maybe sometimes not much more than that. And we were sent out with a guard, an armed guard, for the day to the farm. And then the farmer told us what to do. And the farmers varied. Most of them were very nice. In fact, some of them were very extremely nice. If he did the work, you know, which the farmer got a special rate, you know, he had to pay for it. But it was still cheap labor. And he got the work done, you see, because he had was short of labor. So if he did a decent job, and most of them did, because one thing I must give them, they when they are sent out to work, they usually work. They gave us a quite elaborate lunch, you know. I remember one thing, one in Kentucky, there was he put on a real feast at lunchtime, with southern fried chicken and spare ribs and all that. It was lovely.
And the work that you were required to do wasn't particularly hard?
Well, you could work as hard as you wanted to. I mean, of course, farm work isn't... Well, it's not hard, but it's monotonous. I mean, I remember one job which I had to do, or helped to do, I hated, was pulling the suckers off the tobacco plants. And I'm not very clever well, it wasn't then. And I couldn't distinguish between leaf and sucker, you see. So, I mean, I got into trouble by pulling the wrong thing off. Now, I didn't do it on purpose, you know, but it took me a while to learn, you know. There's a difference in color, you see. The proper tobacco leaf is darker green and the sucker is a sort of a light green, you see, and you have to pull it off to give the good leaf a chance. And hoeing sugar beet, you know, you sometimes hoe more than you should.
Were the POWs organized in the camps? Did they have spokesmen and so on to represent them?
Well, there was an organization. The thing was, there was officers and enlisted were completely separate. The officers had their own camps. There was no officers, no German officers at all. There was no German thing. They were in charge. It was American officers in charge, and American non-commissioned officers, and also some guards, some ordinary guards. The only thing was that some jobs, like the there was a company secretary who was doing the paperwork, who was a German, you see, a prisoner. And various other jobs they had around. But nothing in that way. There was no German command structure in the camp.
Were the POWs allowed to make complaints if they felt anything was
wrong?
Well,
not that... I suppose we were. You could make a complaint, but I don't remember anyone making any complaints. We certainly had nothing to complain about, really, apart from the political troubles that we made for ourselves.
Were you allowed to communicate with home?
Very seldom. In fact, we are allowed to send Red Cross cards. And I later found out, after I got home, that my parents had actually received one, because I was reported as missing. And for a long time, they didn't know whether I was alive or dead. And when the Red Cross card arrived in the middle of the war, they knew I was alive and a prisoner. See? But I think there was only one or two cards. Otherwise, there was no regular correspondence.
How did you come to be repatriated?
How did I come to be
repatriated?
Well, it was a long process. Of course, there were so many prisoners, you see. And after the war was over, there was so much trouble with accommodation and food. And in Europe, you know, there were prisoners, hundreds of thousands, crowded into open camps. And they didn't have... And it took some time to get them all dismissed. So we were shipped from America to England, landed in Liverpool, and spent 3 months being repatriated. You know, they shifted us from camp to camp. We also had to do farm labor during that time. But I landed in Liverpool, spent a few weeks in a camp near Glasgow, but was transferred down to just in Trumpington near Cambridge. Then for a few weeks in a camp in Lincoln. And the last camp was near Bristol, and from there on we were sent home.
What were the conditions in the British camps like in comparison?
Well, in comparison they were bad, but not as far as the treatment was the same. But the food was so much worse than in the States, of course, you see, we had everything. And I remember being rather, you know, coming back from the States, you know, with cartons of cigarettes and all that. And of course, we go to Great Britain. We went off the troop ship into a railroad train, you know, which appeared to us so much smaller than the American ones, you see, tiny. And a Tommy, as we called him, came around distributing white envelopes And we opened it up. And in there was a piece of hardtack and a slice of bully beef. And that was our dinner, you see. And after we headed the States, it was a disappointment. And after that, it was always the same. Sweet tea and porridge for breakfast, and mutton and sweet tea for dinner. And it hardly ever varied. And 15 wood bands a week for smokes. So a rather active black market trade in cigarettes and various things developed, you know, for people who still had it, you know. Because it didn't last all that long, you know. And
Did you complain about it?
Oh, no. I mean, we knew that that was what the British troops got, probably. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't any different from what the others got, you know. I mean, we knew that the Americans had everything, and the Brits, having been so long in the war and having had rationing and all that, no, we understood that.
Were you ever allowed out of the camps in Britain?
Only for farm labor. And also, it was the same as in the States with a guard. The uniforms are different. We were given British uniforms, which had a shape cut out of the back, either a circle or a diamond or something, with a different colored piece of cloth stitched in, you see. That was the only difference, really.
You didn't make any contact with any British families?
No. No. Only if you talked to the farmer, if he was amenable.
When you got back to Austria, what condition did you find Vienna in?
Well, I mean, it was very bleak. Although it was almost a year after the war, it was still very, very poor. The food, in fact, the food was worse than during the war because the rationing system had sort of broken down. My mother was shriveled. She was a rather usually a stout woman, shriveled to nothing. My father had died while I was away in the last days of the war. And I remember arriving in the cattle cars again. Always, we never had. And with a big bag of clothing and things, you know, that from prison camp, we were given a little bit of money by the Austrian state as veterans, and some, I don't forget what, maybe a bar of chocolate or something, and then sent home in our prison uniforms. We had no civilian clothes. And I remember waiting there for, it was in the evening, waiting for a tram to go home, and the streets were so dark, there was hardly any street lighting, and everything was completely deserted, and everything was just a lot of bomb damage still around, you know. It was very, very sad.
You must have seen the Harry Lime film.
Yes.
About post-war Austria.
Yes.
Does that ring a bell when you see it?
Well, the atmosphere, yes, to a certain extent, yes, yes.
Did you ever go into the Russian-occupied zone of Vienna?
Oh, yes. I had a girl.